Israel is always prepared for disaster. But the emergency teams that raced to a West Jerusalem wedding hall encountered an extraordinary scene. 700 guests were dancing on the top floor of the garish Versailles Hall when the building collapsed. Itti Ratzi was working in a restaurant opposite.
I heard a very, very big bang. Then we go there to help the people. And I saw a lot of people on the ground and they're under the stones, a lot of stones under the people, and they're screaming.
This being Jerusalem, the first assumption was that a bomb had caused the devastation. In fact, it was probably bad building design. That's little consolation to the bereaved and injured. Amongst the survivors, the bride and groom, and this young boy. He fell through three stories. As paramedics struggled to keep him alive, it emerged he'd forgotten his name.
They asked him, what's your name? So he says, Raviv. So they asked him, what's your last name? I don't know. I'm very cold, please take me fast. I'm freezing. I said, what's your mother's name? He says, I don't know. Your father's name? I don't know. So he doesn't remember his last name.
Hundreds of those who survived owe their lives to the people who reached the scene in those first minutes. With their bare hands, they removed what rubble they could before the paramedics like Johnny Finn arrived.
I saw about 20 people buried underneath, and we couldn't get them out. Simply couldn't get them out. They were completely, there was concrete and sand and cement all over the place. We couldn't get them out.
It's now several hours after this building collapsed without any warning, and I'm now up on a balcony opposite looking at it. The area's been floodlit, and all you can see is a vast empty cavern, all that remains at the inside of this wedding hall. Near the bottom, there are now teams of rescue workers who are sifting through the rubble as gingerly as they possibly can, trying to find signs of life. They're being aided by specially trained dogs and heavy lifting equipment. This operation could go on for several days.
Stephen Gibbs reporting from the scene of the disaster in Jerusalem. The Rwandan President Paul Kagame has told a visiting United Nations delegation that the Security Council could do more to help end the conflicts in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The UN team has already been to Tanzania and Burundi and travels to Uganda today. Helen Vesperini reports.
The United Nations delegation and the Rwandan authorities appeared to have held fairly cordial talks despite stormy relations in the recent past. The head of the Security Council delegation, Jean-David Levite, said his team had been very encouraged by all its meetings with heads of state in the region and insisted that the heads of state involved in the Great Lakes conflicts should take the dialogue they have started further. President Kagame did say he thought that in spite of what the Security Council likes to say about having limited scope for intervention, he thought the Council's problem was not one of means, but more of political will. He reiterated that only border security concerns were keeping Rwandan troops in Congo. The Security Council said the militia groups on the loose in Congo and who are causing the border security problem were foremost among the UN's preoccupations. Relations between Rwanda and the UN have been strained ever since the 1994 genocide. Rwanda feels the UN let it down miserably and even prolonged the killing with the creation of the so-called safe haven, the turquoise zone.
Helen Vesperini reporting. The Chinese President Jiang Zemin has opened a meeting of Asian and European foreign ministers in Beijing with a speech calling for an end to what he said was an unjust and irrational world order. The forum is aimed at strengthening dialogue between Asian and European countries and follows a string of bilateral meetings, notably between the European Union and China. In his speech, Mr. Jiang criticised the growing gap in wealth between North and South. But a BBC correspondent in Beijing says that what China really dislikes is the global dominance of the United States, and it sees Europe as a useful counterbalance. A controversial Hollywood film about the bombing of Pearl Harbor goes on general release in the United States today. The movie is one of the most expensive ever made, and the centerpiece is a 40-minute special effects sequence depicting the Japanese air attack on the U.S. Pacific Fleet in 1941. 2,400 Americans were killed in the attack, prompting America to enter the Second World War. But fears have been raised that the film could provoke anti-Asian sentiment in America. Lillian Kimura of the Japanese-American Citizens League says they're concerned about the potential for a backlash against Japanese-American communities.
Americans of Japanese ancestry were incarcerated by the United States government for over 3 years. And there has been, in recent months, several incidents in the Asian American community related to negative comments and with the United States spy plane being downed in China. This is one more thing that has been added.
Lillian Kimura of the Japanese American Citizens League. You're listening to World Briefing from the BBC. Our main news today, at least 25 people have been killed and hundreds more injured after a building in Jerusalem collapsed. Emergency teams are trying to reach survivors trapped under the rubble. And the Lebanese President Emil Lahoud has marked the first anniversary of Israel's withdrawal from southern Lebanon with a call for a reassessment of the Middle East peace process. Tension across the border with Israel remains high. On Thursday, Israel shot down a Lebanese civilian plane. Israel has defended this action, saying they were concerned it might have been an attempted suicide attack to mark the anniversary. Lebanon is marking the occasion with a national holiday. Barbara Plett reports now from the Lebanese capital, Beirut.
There will be rallies and demonstrations, with participation expected from groups across the political spectrum. But President Lahoud's statements reflected the sad reality that the withdrawal did not bring peace. And the scale of Israeli military power used against the Palestinian uprising has dampened the sense of celebration here. Mr. Lahoud said Israeli intransigence had brought the region to the brink of an all-out confrontation and urged a review of the peace process. He also said Beirut would continue to oppose Israel's occupation of the Sheba Farms, a tiny bit of land captured by Israel from Syria in 1967, but claimed by Lebanon. Syria backs that claim, which gives it a front to fight a proxy war with Israel through links with Hezbollah.
That report from Barbara Plett. The Israeli army says a booby-trapped truck exploded near an Israeli army post in the Gaza Strip. It says the explosion occurred on the main road near a Jewish settlement, but that no one was hurt. However, Palestinian security officials say the vehicle was hit by an Israeli tank shell. The Macedonian army is continuing its offensive against a string of rebel-held villages in the north of the country. They claim some military successes already, the capture of one village and entry into another. Meanwhile, a new wave of refugees crossing the border into Serbia has been reported by the United Nations Refugee Agency. From the capital Skopje, Nick Thorpe reports.
A Macedonian army spokesman has said that all rebel-held villages will be recaptured in this offensive. One, Loyani, is already said to be fully in their hands, and by Thursday evening, the army was moving through another, Vakshinze. Reports from the area say that shooting continued after midnight. The UNHCR have reported that 1,500 refugees from Loyani have fled across the border into Serbia. The army has not mentioned any casualties of its own since the operation started early on Thursday. The rebels have released the names and ages of seven civilians they say died in Slupčani when the cellar they were sheltering in was hit by a shell fired by the army. They include six people from one family, three of them children. There is no independent confirmation of the report. The Macedonian authorities are hoping for a quick victory. Any drawn-out battle could increase the sympathy for the rebels among the Albanian community in Macedonia, where they make up an estimated third of the population. A former interior minister, Lubomir Frčkovski, has argued that what is needed now is to defeat the rebels with force as a precondition for a compromise with moderate Albanians on their demands for greater rights.
Nick Thorpe. A federal judge in Brazil has declared the government's plan to ration electricity unconstitutional. The country is facing a severe energy crisis because of lack of rain. But the ruling puts into doubt the government's plan to avoid California-style blackouts. As our Brazil correspondent Tom Gibb reports, the alternative could end up, or an alternative plan anyway, could end up giving Brazilians Mondays off work.
The government had hoped to force Brazilians to cut their consumption of electricity by 20%. By imposing fines and cutting the supply of any household which exceeds the quota. In this way, they hope to prevent more generalized power blackouts. However, from the start, the plan, due to come into force next month, has been fraught with difficulties. In practice, the electricity companies say they don't have enough manpower to physically cut off the supply of all those breaking the rules. Now, a federal judge has declared the punishments unconstitutional. The ruling was in response to a case brought by a state ombudsman against the federal government. The country's president, Fernando Henrique Cardoso, earlier this week responded to threats of judicial action by asking which planet those opposing the government rationing plan lived on. While the government will certainly appeal the ruling, probably right up to the Supreme Court, it has said it'll stick by whatever the courts decide. An alternative plan being considered, should generalized power cuts become necessary, is to give Brazilians in much of the country Mondays off work. That would almost certainly be popular, but it's likely to face opposition from industry because of lost production.
Tom Gibb. A group of Native American Indians have suffered a setback in their continuing fight to control their own affairs. The Mohawks on the Akwesasne Reserve near Montreal have never recognized the border between the United States and Canada, which runs through their territory. But now the Supreme Court of Canada has ruled they'll have to pay duty on goods bought in the United States. It could frustrate their plans to create a Native American free trade zone. Mike Fox reports from Montreal.
This case started in 1988 when the Akwesasne Grand Chief, Michael Mitchell, decided to test what he feels is the Mohawk right to freely cross the border through their reserve without having to pay duty on goods bought in the US. When stopped at the Canadian Customs Post on the reserve, he refused to pay duty on his newly bought Bible, blankets, motor oil and washing machine. Two lower courts upheld his right not to pay, agreeing with the Mohawks that they had a constitutional right established under treaties drawn up with the original settlers in North America. But the Supreme Court has taken a much tougher attitude. In a unanimous ruling, the seven judges said there was only tenuous evidence of any Mohawk trading across the St. Lawrence River in the past, or that this formed a major part of their culture. Chief Mitchell will now have to pay the $361 of duty. But the Mohawks say they'll continue to fight for recognition of rights which they say predate the very existence of Canada. One Akwesasne chief told the BBC those rights continue to exist, whether or not they're recognised by the Canadian government. He says many Mohawks already negotiate duty waivers on goods, and they'll press ahead with negotiations with customs officials. They want to set up a free trade zone where they could sell goods duty-free to other native peoples from the rest of Canada, creating a major source of money and jobs.
Mike Fox in Montreal. You're listening to the BBC in London. Our main news today, at least 25 people have been killed and hundreds more injured after a building in Jerusalem collapsed. Emergency teams are trying to reach survivors trapped under the rubble. And the United States Attorney General says the execution of the Oklahoma bomber Timothy McVeigh will take place on June the 11th without any more delays.
A building packed with hundreds of wedding guests has collapsed in Jerusalem, killing at least 25 people. Hundreds more have been injured, and rescue workers say around 50 people are still unaccounted for. The collapse appears to have been the result of structural failure. The Israeli army says that a booby-trapped truck exploded near an Israeli army post in the Gaza Strip. It says no one was hurt. Palestinian security officials say that the vehicle was hit by an Israeli tank shell. The American Attorney General has announced that the execution of the Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh will go ahead in June as planned. He said the newly released FBI documents, not seen during the trial, contained no new evidence to question McVeigh's guilt. Control of the U.S. Senate has switched from the Republicans to the Democrats following the resignation from the Republicans of Senator James Jeffords, for reasons, he said, of principle and conscience. He'll sit as an independent. The chairman of the United States Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan, says the current period of slow growth in the American economy hasn't ended, and business activity could still weaken further. He says if so, there'll be what he called a further policy response. The Lebanese president, Emil Lahoud, has marked the first anniversary of Israel's withdrawal from South Lebanon with a call for a reappraisal of the Middle East peace process. Mr. Lahoud accused Israel of bringing the region to the brink of an all-out confrontation. The American Secretary of State Colin Powell is due to visit an aid center in the township of Soweto today. Mr. Powell is on a four-nation tour of Africa.
More than 100 former leprosy patients in Japan who were forcibly quarantined in special medical centres, even though they could have been treated as hospital patients, have received a formal apology from the Prime Minister. 2 days ago, the government decided not to appeal against a court ruling that it must pay compensation to the patients. BBC News.
BBC World Service. Well, it's time now for business news with Manuela Saragossa.
Coming up, we have analysis on the latest thoughts from the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan, after he gave an eagerly awaited assessment of the state of the United States economy. Our paper review looks at the latest European business stories as seen through the eyes of the Europe Wall Street Journal, and what hope for India's ambitions to do something about its chronic shortage of electricity. We hear how a bitter relations between the Indian authorities and the US power company Enron has fulfilled the worst fears of international investors. When Alan Greenspan, the chairman of the most powerful central bank in the world, has something to say about the state of the American economy, the world takes note. And on Thursday, he reaffirmed his position that the US economy should recover by the end of the year. Mr. Greenspan told the Economic Club in New York last night that the aggressive interest rate cuts made earlier this year should offer substantial support to the shaky economy. But he also indicated there would be more interest rate cuts if needed. James Whittington reports.
Alan Greenspan has not shared his thoughts on the state of the United States economy since February, so the speech in New York was eagerly anticipated just to check that he'd not changed his mind too much over the past few months.
The period of subpar economic growth is not yet over, and we are not free of the risk that economic weakness will be greater than currently anticipated, requiring further policy response. But we also need to be aware that our front-loaded policy actions this year should be providing substantial support for a strengthening of economic activity later this year.
Mr. Greenspan also stressed that inflation was under control, thereby leaving open the possibility of more interest rate cuts should the economy deteriorate further. So at this stage, he appears to be waiting to see what effect his actions so far will have. This is a view confirmed by Carl Weinberg from High Frequency Economics in New York.
What we read from Mr. Greenspan's comments is that the Fed will now adopt a wait-and-see attitude and give themselves some time to assess whether the measures they've taken already, which are substantial, are going to have an impact on the economy.
The Federal Reserve is not due to meet again on the subject of interest rates until the 27th of June, but Mr. Greenspan's latest offering suggests that at this stage, there should be no surprises before then.
James Whittington reporting. Now to news of the stock markets in Asia, and Tokyo's Nikkei average fell 0.9%. In point terms, it was down 129 at 13,765. Meanwhile, Hong Kong's Hang Seng index is little moved at 13,808. Also, Singapore's Straits Times index and Australia's All Ordinaries index both very little moved. Bombay's 30-share index is down 0.1%, again little moved at 3680. Meanwhile, in London, the 100-share index has opened down 0.3% at 58.97. On Thursday on Wall Street, the Dow rose 0.2% to 11,122, while the high-tech Nasdaq rose 1.7% to 2,282. Well, to check on the day's events on Wall Street, here's Peter Cardillo, Research Director at Westphalia Investments.
It was a nice pop here in most of the tech stocks right across the board, both the over-the-counter and some of the high-flying tech stocks on the New York Stock Exchange, such as IBM, Hewlett-Packard, and Microsoft. We also had the bank stocks do quite nicely. Most of the large financial institutions all showed gains towards the end of the day, along with some of the cyclical stocks. So all in all, with the exception of energy and pharmaceutical stocks, the market had a fairly good day.
That was Peter Cardillo of Westphalia Investments. Now on the currency markets, the latest London rates from Reuters, and the dollar is up 0.3 Japanese yen at 120.3 yen. The euro is up 0.5 cents at 86.2 US cents. It's also trading at 61 British pence, and the pound's at $1.41.5. Time now for our regular look at what's making headlines in the European business press. And today we go to the Europe Wall Street Journal. There are a couple of stories today in the paper which focus on Europe's changing attitude to corporate mergers in the business sector. The paper leads on Volkswagen considering selling off its Audi unit. A short while ago, I discussed this with the paper's editor, Fred Kemp.
Today's was the sort of paper an editor loves to wake up to. We have two front page stories about Europe trying to become Europe, and that's not always an easy process. The first is an exclusive report on Volkswagen considering dramatic moves to actually boost up its share price and make itself still independent, and that includes selling a chunk of its premium Audi brand. At issue is what in Germany is known as the Volkswagen Law, and that says no investor can hold more than 20% of the company. Lower Saxony has 20% of the company. The EC, the European Commission, wants to remove this law. And, of course, that means Volkswagen has to get ready. Its share price is so cheap that it could easily be a takeover target if it doesn't find ways to boost its stock price.
Do you think it'll work?
Well, some people think it is one-fourth of the company's revenue, Audi is, so that certainly is a good way to bring in some money. But on the other hand, some analysts doubt whether selling this chunk of Audi would really have the desired effect. I'm not really sure it would be enough to prevent a takeover because its share price is so much lower than other companies in the sector.
Now, Fred, the other story in your paper, the Italian government has passed a decree aimed at halting the incursion of the French power giant, which bought 20% of Monte Edison.
Right. This is the other part of the story, second part of the story of Europe trying to become Europe. EDF bought 20% of Edison. Well, when you buy 20% of a company, you sort of think you're going to get 20% of the voting rights. But the Italian government passed a decree that would limit the voting rights to 2%. Their argument is, as long as EDF is as heavily owned by the French government as it is, they're not going to let it into the Italian system, which has opened up much more than the French system has. The same sort of thing has happened in Spain as well.
Now, talking of companies sharing off parts of their business, BT last night, you're carrying a story saying that BT was considering selling its directory unit, Yell. At least it had a bid for that unit.
Absolutely. This is really a story about BT taking these moves that it wanted to take to reduce the debt that it's built up, but how they're not going to work out to help it quite enough. It wants to sell Yell. It thought it could get more than 3 billion euros out of it. In the end, it thought it would get about 3 billion pounds out of it. In the end, it will get 2 billion pounds. That means it's going to get a lot less because the U.S. regulators earlier this month voted to cap Yell's advertising fees. In short, it means that BT's got to decide whether to accept an offer that's going to give it much less money than it wanted to get out of this.
I was speaking there to Fred Kemp, editor of the Europe Wall Street Journal. A look at what the other papers are saying, and the Financial Times has an interview with Michael Power, chairman of the U.S. Federal Communications Commission. Mr. Power sets out a radical agenda to cut back regulation of media and telecommunications that the paper says could spark a wave of consolidation on both sides of the Atlantic. And The Guardian has a story on the Durex condom maker SS International, which admitted yesterday to £25 million of bogus sales which have appeared on its accounts over the past 2 years. Its share price fell nearly 10% yesterday, and analysts have questioned whether the company can maintain interest payments on its debt. Now, it's been a bad week for the Indian power sector. Earlier this week, the U.S. power company Enron moved to pull out of its troubled $2.1 billion power project in the state of Maharashtra. And now India's Maharashtra State Electricity Board, the sole customer of Enron's troubled power project in India, has said it is rescinding its contract to buy electricity from the company, escalating the bitter fight between the two sides over unpaid bills. As Mark Tully writes from Delhi, the Enron project has now become so controversial that it's more likely to dissuade rather than persuade other investors to come to India's power sector.
With the thermometer soaring beyond 40 degrees centigrade, I wait anxiously for the bang, which signals that the power to my ancient air conditioner has been cut off. But I and other citizens of Delhi are lucky. We face hours without electricity. In some parts of India, it can be days. Economists have identified India's chronic shortage of power as a roadblock which has to be removed if the country is ever to match China's growth rate. But India's hopes of attracting foreign investment in the power sector have suffered a severe setback, with the recent publication of a report that speaks of an inexcusable failure of governance in negotiations with the American company Enron. The laboriously negotiated on-off-on Enron power project was to be an example which would attract other international investors. Instead, the State Electricity Board, which was to purchase the power, has defaulted. Enron might well pull out of India, and the project has fulfilled the worst fears of international investors who were already reluctant to venture into India's bureaucratic jungle. So who's to blame? Well, according to the report on Enron, the main culprits are the Electricity Board and the government of the state of Maharashtra. They're charged with making extremely questionable assumptions, failing to insist on competitive bidding, ignoring warnings about the demand for power at the agreed price, and negligence on several other counts too. But it wasn't the experts, it was the politicians who took the decisions on Enron. The project became a political football, which was kicked into touch by the right-wing Hindu Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP, when they were in opposition, but was revived after fresh negotiations when they were elected. Now that the BJP no longer rules Maharashtra, the new government is anxious to rid itself of the burden of purchasing Enron's expensive power. Even now, Enron might be saved if it's allowed to sell power directly to its customers. But under the law as it stands, power companies can only sell to the bankrupt state electricity boards. Which brings us back to politicians and their henchmen, the bureaucrats, often described as knowing awfully little about an awful lot. That law is a relic of the old Indian-controlled economy, known as the Neta Babu Raj, or Raj of the politician and the bureaucrat, whose powers and perks it was designed to protect. In spite of India's avowed conversion to liberal economics, much of the Neta Babu Raj remains intact, for obvious reasons. But Enron can't escape their share of the blame. They should not have taken advantage of the inexcusable failure of governance to strike a deal which, while manifestly in the company's favour, was always going to be an embarrassment to the politicians and bureaucrats who negotiated it. There are also unanswered questions about how Enron persuaded the BJP politicians to change their minds. So the Enron story is a cautionary tale. For India, keep politics out of power and other infrastructure projects. And for foreign investors, make sure the bargain struck is a bargain that will stick. Mark Tully in Delhi for BBC World Business Report.
On now to news from the commodity markets, and gold is trading at $279.25 an ounce. That's down $6.8 from Thursday afternoon's London fix. The Australian dollar, meanwhile, is at 52.22 US cents. Other figures for the currency markets, the US dollar's at 1 Swiss franc 77.2, 46.95 Indian rupees, and 62.48 Pakistani rupees. That's it from this World Business Report. Ian.
Thank you, Manuela Saragossa. Now, the latest news headlines at 7:45 GMT. At least 25 people have been killed and hundreds more injured after a building in Jerusalem collapsed. Emergency teams are trying to reach survivors trapped under the rubble. The U.S. Attorney General says the execution of the Oklahoma bomber Timothy McVeigh will take place on June the 11th without any more delays. And the Lebanese president has accused Israel of bringing the Middle East to the brink of war. He was speaking on the first anniversary of Israel's withdrawal from southern Lebanon. Now, it's time for today's analysis. The singer-songwriter Bob Dylan has just turned 60. In the 1960s, he was hailed as the king of the protest song. His music seemed to capture the mood of those turbulent years. Since then, his musical style has undergone several shifts, as has his reputation. And the world's moved on too. Record companies seem more preoccupied with selling manufactured boy and girl bands around the world. So is there still a place for the protest song? Alice Cairns considers if the times really have changed.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched.
Bob Dylan has always been a controversial figure. There are those who've never forgiven him for abandoning the purity of the acoustic guitar, and others who rate him as one of the most important musicians of the century.
Oh, the times they are a-changin'.
But almost everyone agrees he bridged the gap between traditional music and popular music like nobody else.
Before Bob Dylan, the protest songs, they were muted, they were hidden. They were passed through the underclass as ways of protesting within themselves. Bob Dylan brought protest to a much, much wider audience. He was the person who held a mirror to mainstream America and said, things are not right here.
And, says music journalist John Azlewood, it wasn't just young Americans who were carried along by what Dylan was doing.
Every nation heard Bob Dylan. Even the countries which couldn't understand the intricacies of the language that he was using, they understood the feel and the notion that protest was suddenly a valid thing. So, in every society, apart from totalitarian ones, you had questioning singer-songwriters. And that's how the protest movement in song exploded throughout the world.
And mothers and fathers throughout the land, and don't criticize what you can't understand.
In America, Dylan's songs alarmed middle-class parents. In other countries, his fellow singers were seen as a much more serious threat.
Yo no canto por cantar, ni por tener buena voz. Canto porque la guitarra tiene sentido y razón.
Victor Jara was Chile's version of Bob Dylan. He played an active part in the movement that brought President Salvador Allende's socialist government to power in 1970. Robin Denslow is the author of a book about pop and politics.
Jara was part of this, the Nuevo Canción, the new song movement, singing out against injustice as he saw it at a time when military regimes were taking over across South America. And just to show how much governments cared about the power of pop music and pop songs, Victor Jara was picked up along with hundreds of others of left-wingers and alleged subversives, thrown into a small stadium in Santiago, where when you can still see people have scrawled his name on the wall. He was then found dead along near a railway track. So he paid the ultimate price, really, for protest singing.
Ni cosa que se parezca, mi canto es de los andarios. Yeah. You are my fire, the one desire.
Nowadays, young Chileans are much more likely to crowd stadiums in Santiago to hear bands like the Backstreet Boys.
I want it that way, but we...
The Backstreet Boys from the United States are one of the most successful boy bands in the world, a result of considerable marketing, says John Azlewood.
What record companies understood is that sex is universal, that people fancy pretty young boys in bands. And that is a universal message as much as Bob Dylan's protest songs was. And they realised that if you have a simple clunking beat, it doesn't really matter what they're saying. And the lyrics are essentially simplistic. And these bands, they are of course interchangeable.
With the record companies spending so much money to package their singers, how easy is it for those with a less palatable message to be heard? Some commentators have coined the expression market censorship to describe the way the major record labels control what the public gets to hear.
If you talk to a young musician in Denmark, for example, he or she will always say that I'm censored by the record label and so on. If you talk to the record labels themselves, they will say, well, in a way we feel we are censored from the DJs in the radio stations because they don't play our music, so it's like a circle.
Marie Torpa is from FreeMuse, an organization that supports artistic freedom for musicians around the world.
On the other hand, in the US, where I personally see rap music as very political music, and maybe the protest songs of today, like Bob Dylan in the 60s, because it comes from people who are at the bottom of the society and they protest against the society, they have better sales for that music when it is political and when they receive the explicit lyrics on the CDs. The police coming straight from the-
that rap presents itself now. It's an anguished howl, but it's not against the government. They're not protesting in the way that Bob Dylan was. But because they swear, because they talk explicitly about sex, because they talk about shooting and the mores and values of the underclass, then in a sense it is rebellious. No one else is talking about this.
Zombie, oh zombie.
Zombie, oh zombie.
Zombie, oh zombie.
But there have been plenty of artists performing directly political songs. Robin Denslow again.
Those who stood out against what they saw as oppression have suffered in Africa as they did elsewhere. I mean, Fela Kuti in Nigeria used his really cheerful dance music as a vicious weapon to parody and attack and satirise a whole series of military governments. He was jailed on what appeared to be trumped-up charges on several occasions. And then down in Zimbabwe, there were singers like Thomas Mapfumo, who has had a lengthy career speaking very much as a voice of the people, firstly against UDI and against Ian Smith. And he's gone on in the independence era to criticise the Mugabe government over its economic policies and what he sees as the suffering of the people.
Today, we are facing so many problems in this country. Some people think they have to be liberated again. There's a song called Mamvemve, which means the country's economy is in tatters. They didn't like that, but that's the truth. That's the truth. The country is in tatters. People are being killed here. They are being threatened. And this, the other song, Disaster.
Marie Torpa says performers like Thomas Mapfumo are far more than just musicians.
Music itself has a very, very strong power. It can influence people to think and to reflect. And in a country like Zimbabwe, the music is even more important than the written word or what you can read in articles, etc. So the music is music that carries messages, one sort or the other, are really important, especially in the third world.
And not only in the developing world. Serbia has its own highly politicised music scene, which played its part in the downfall of Slobodan Milosevic last year. Toma Gruic is the musical director of the independent Belgrade radio station B92.
The music scene in Serbia changed significantly and very deeply throughout the 90s because the whole new breed of rock bands emerged, and the bands with the new kind of attitude and new kind of consciousness. Their songs didn't need to be openly political. It was more a matter of expressing an attitude towards the whole atmosphere in the society.
This song, Shane, by the Serbian band Iceburn, was one of many that made young Serbians feel they were not alone, with devastating consequences for the Milosevic regime, says Toma Gruic.
B92 has organized two tours of Serbia with some of the most popular bands, and the first one was in December 1999. And the second one was just before the elections in August and September last year. The concept was something like Rock the Vote in America, you know, to appeal to the young people who have never voted before. But the most important thing is that showed that there are many of us. When you go somewhere and you see that there are many others who think like you, who share the general spirit.
It's this ability to make people think they can change things that makes a protest song, says John Hazelwood, rather than the actual content of the lyrics.
A very, very good example of this is a song called Things Can Only Get Better by the Northern Irish group D-Ream. Now, originally, it was written as a sort of vague, naive plea for the two warring factions in Northern Ireland, the Roman Catholic and the Protestant communities, to come together. Now, when it became a hit, the subtlety of a lyric about Northern Ireland was lost on the wider British public. They just thought it was a fantastic song. And then there was a third twist to this term when, during the last days of the Conservative administration in Great Britain, the Labour Party fought an election which eventually put them into power. Their slogan, their campaign song, was "Things Can Only Get Better" by Doreen.
A great song could also become a great symbol. It can summarise a cause and it can stand for a whole movement, even if the lyrics themselves aren't about that movement. It can become a dangerous thing to sing if the authorities so decree. We've taken Nkosi Sikelel' Afrika, the famous hymn, which started out as a hymn, God Bless Africa, which was then taken up by the ANC in the anti-apartheid struggle, and became very much a nationalist song, and has moved on now to become a national anthem.
Bob Dylan, who wrote the anthems of the 60s radicals, has today become part of the establishment. But the idea that popular song can change how people think, and even how countries are run, is still as fresh as ever.
Today's analysis on protest songs was written and presented by Alice Cairns.